ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Jewish leaders call on politicians to resolve their differences and pass new laws to tackle hate speech. Also, Victorians who've lost their homes in the bushfires worry about finding a new place in the tough rental market. And the athletes who can run 100 kilometres and then keep on going.
I think the more that I do them, the more that I really love them. Most other races, you know where the finish line is. So unlike any other format, you can really push to your absolute limit.
First this evening, the head of Australia's peak Jewish body is pleading with the country's political leaders to come together to pass laws aimed at tackling anti-Semitism. The Albanese government is introducing a wide-ranging bill seeking to crack down on hate speech and guns in an emergency two-day sitting of Parliament next week. But its path through Parliament is looking increasingly difficult, with both the Coalition and the Greens indicating they won't support the proposed laws in their current form. Oliver Gordon has more.
Bipartisanship can be hard to come by in Canberra, but after last month's Bondi terror attack, the country's top Jewish group is pleading for it.
They owe it to the country.
That's the Executive Council of Australian Jewry's chief executive, Peter Wertheim. He doesn't think the government's proposed hate speech reforms are perfect, but he argues a wholesale rejection of them is not warranted.
We mustn't allow progress towards an effective regime to proscribe hate speech to be delayed or defeated simply because it has some drawbacks and it's not perfect. We need to make progress in that direction. The events of last month at Bondi Beach illustrate how intolerable the status quo is and how ineffective the laws have been to date.
There's a growing chorus of criticism of the proposed legislation from within the coalition. In recent days, several coalition MPs have argued a proposed new hate speech offence could stifle free speech, and others suggest gun reforms included in the legislation could unfairly target legal firearm owners. Opposition leader Susan Lee.
The opposition has extremely serious concerns. The legislation does not address the real issues that gave rise to the Bondi attack. It doesn't address Islamic extremism. It doesn't address ISIS influence. And it doesn't address the rise of anti-Semitism and the associated terrorist threat in Australia.
Asked if the coalition would seek amendments to this legislation, Ms. Lee suggested it was looking unlikely.
From what we have seen so far, it looks pretty unsalvageable.
The laws will require the support of either the Coalition or Greens to pass through Parliament. So they hit another roadblock this afternoon when the Greens indicated they would not support the legislation in its current form. Greens Senator David Shoebridge says the minor party is seeking protections for other minority groups.
Everybody needs protection. The same hateful ideology that was directed against the Jewish community at Bondi could have as easily been directed against women in positions of power or the LGBTIQ community.
Labor frontbenchers have indicated the government is open to expanding protections to other groups, and negotiations with the Greens are ongoing. It's not only politicians raising concerns about the proposed legislation. The Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, which represents journalists, including many employed by the ABC, is worried the hate speech laws could have a chilling effect on press freedom. Here's Cassie Derrick.
At the moment, what this is looking at doing is paving the way to be able to target people that are potentially criticising power, and that cannot happen. It will only lead to making our democracy more divided and more closed off.
And constitutional law expert Professor Anne Toomey says the planned changes could have unintended consequences.
If you just imagine a world where you've got an autocratic leader who's been elected and puts all their cronies into places of power to give them the advice that they want, suddenly you've got a power to go around banning all these groups that you think are your enemies and you don't like.
Facing a gridlocked parliament, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has hit out at the coalition, saying it's stunning some of his opponents want more time to look over the bill, after repeatedly calling for fast action to recall Parliament in the days after the Bondi attack. But he remains committed to passing the legislation.
And I call upon all members and senators to engage constructively, which is what the Executive Council of Australian Jury have called for today.
The Executive Council of Australian Juries, Peter Wertheim, is calling for cooperation.
Both the government and the coalition have to give a little ground, work to achieve an optimum outcome that might not be perfect from the perspective of either of them, but is an outcome they can live with.
The laws are set to be debated during a recall of Parliament next Monday and Tuesday.
Oliver Gordon. More than 200 homes have been destroyed in Victoria's bushfire disaster, and many of the people who've lost their places are now struggling to find somewhere to live in what was already a very tight rental market. Kimberly Price reports.
When the Juni family moved to Harcourt in central Victoria just 4 weeks ago, Nick thought he'd found a slice of paradise for his family.
Yeah, it was amazing. Trees everywhere. It was a dream.
But on Friday, everything changed. His wife Gladys and their three children made a lucky escape from the devastating fire that ripped through their town.
The fire was all around the house and very strong from the side, and suddenly it just started on the deck. We had a plastic deck that had just been installed, and once the deck started to burn, then the pergola on the top collapsed. The window exploded.
More than 700 structures have now been destroyed by more than a dozen bushfires across Victoria, including 228 homes. 47 of those homes were in Harcourt, and one of them was the Juni family's rental property. Nick Juni says the family will try to rent again locally.
We're tired, and finding a rental's like hard at the best of times. We're trying to find a place.
We're resilient, so we'll try to our best to...
We want to find a place.
For people like the Junis, this disaster comes amid an extremely difficult rental market. The vacancy rate in Harcourt and surrounding towns is well under 1%, according to market insight group PropTrack. And a new report by real estate company Domain, looking at the market nationwide, suggests Australian renters are reaching the absolute limit of what they can afford to pay. Domain's Chief of Research and Economics, Dr. Nicola Powell, says renters are being forced to consider other options.
So they opt for cheaper property types, or they opt for cheaper locations in order to find something that's within their budget, or they go to more dramatic options, moving back in with family and friends, or renting out a room or going into a house share.
For those affected by the Victorian fires, Premier Jacinta Allen says help is available.
We've lost homes and businesses and prime agricultural land, and my message very clearly to those communities is my government will continue to stand with you on the long recovery journey ahead.
The state government's personal hardship assistance program has opened, and for those who have lost their principal place of residence, a one-off payment of up to $680 per person and $340 per child is available, up to a maximum of $2,380 per family. Emergency accommodation providers are on the ground to support those affected, but Rod Prince, who runs Castlemaine Boutique Accommodation in central Victoria, says there are some local solutions available.
Well, we've got about 16 properties that we can open up. We can accommodate up to 140 guests.
However, Rod Prince says insurance companies need to step up and help cover the cost of temporary accommodation stays.
Look, usually you get a temporary accommodation supplied by the insurance companies, get them in quickly at whatever rate. Then you negotiate with the insurance companies for a long-term stay.
The housing crisis caused by these fires raises memories of the Black Summer fires across southeastern Australia at the end of 2019. One of the hardest-hit communities in that disaster was Mallacoota on Victoria's far east coast. The town lost 128 homes, sparking a long-lasting housing shortage that badly affected locals. Mallacoota real estate agent agent Kerry Warren was involved in a recovery association trying to solve that crisis. She says 6 years on, there are lessons that can be put into place now.
It needs to be really clear from the start what assistance is on offer. People shouldn't have to go through losing their homes and then deal with the red tape of what assistance can we get.
Kerry Warren says it's crucial that cleanup efforts are fast-tracked so that the rebuilding of homes can begin as soon as possible.
That report from Kimberly Price, Tyrone Dalton and Anna McGuinness. After telling protesters in Iran that American help was on the way, Donald Trump's plans for the country are still unclear. The US president now says he's been told, quote, on good authority, that the killing of protesters by the Islamic Republic security forces has stopped, as well as the planned executions of those arrested in the uprising. Human rights activists put the protester death toll at more than 2,500 people, but there are unconfirmed reports the toll is far higher. For more on the situation in Iran, I spoke to Dr. Sharam Dana, a senior law lecturer at Griffith University. His parents fled Iran in the 1970s because of religious persecution and settled in Queensland. Dr. Dana, Donald Trump now says he's been told on good authority that the Iranian regime is stopping the killings and no executions are planned. Do you think that information that he says he has can be relied on?
It's hard to think that any of this is really decisive for Trump. It seems that he acts for whatever reasons he wishes to act, and it often is not consistent with the explanations or the reasons he gives us for what he wants to know why. So, I mean, I think as a matter of normal diplomacy, you'd want to gather information as much as you can from as many sources as you can and to have a balanced consideration. But whether or not Trump approaches this way is quite speculative.
Do you think President Trump is perhaps now backing away from his threat to intervene in Iran?
What maybe publicly he has moderated his words a little bit, but this means nothing in terms of what his intentions are. I mean, we have a consistent pattern with Trump of saying one thing and doing something else. So whatever he's saying externally can not really be relied on too greatly. I mean, I think what the focus we should have on this is that what we're witnessing in Iran right now is not just scattered, isolated protests. You know, what we're seeing is a sustained expression of public anger rooted in this regime's brutality and in its long-standing human rights violations. And we see what we haven't seen in a long time. We've seen protests in Iran before, and even in the last few years, usually at big cities like Tehran or other major cities. But what we're seeing now is quite different. In all 31 provinces and across Iran, we have uprisings. And these uprisings are by students, by farmers, in rural areas, not just in the big cities, by conservative Muslims. So we haven't seen a scale of protests at this level of uprising since the last one, which toppled the previous regime in 1979.
So given that the protests are so widespread, do you think the regime can be toppled this time?
Well, I think you can tell by its own reaction, there is a lot of fear among the regime about where this could go. With this level of intensity in the protest, I think this could be early signals for the regime that fundamental change is necessary.
Dr. Dana, at international law, do you think there will eventually be any punishment of the regime for the killings of thousands of protesters?
We could hope so. We could hope so. I mean, the question would be what court would have jurisdiction over these events? I mean, Iran is not a party to the ICC, so criminal accountability by ICC, I'm referring to the International Criminal Court. Criminal accountability is unlikely because there's no court that would have jurisdiction over the events that are going on. Whether there could be some accountability through the United Nations human rights mechanisms, because Iran is a party to a number of different human rights instruments, that could be a possibility, but it wouldn't result in criminal accountability. It would be just some sort of state responsibility that would be identified.
For there to be any punishment, would it be necessary for the regime to be overthrown?
Well, if the regime is overthrown, punishment can be effectuated domestically under domestic laws, right? What this regime is doing is criminal. It's murderous. So there could be accountability under domestic law.
Dr. Dana, the son of the late Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, wants to return to lead the country. Is that something the protesters support?
There's been some reporting that suggests that there are groups within Iran that are supportive of the return of the Shah or the Shah's son, and for Iran to return to some sort of monarchy. There's been some suggestions of that. I don't know if that would be the solution. I mean, we could have a symbolic monarchy, as we do here in Australia, but in terms of where the power lies with regards to the governance of society, I think the only way forward effective for Iran is to have some sort of a democratic process, some sort of democratic assembly, a parliament whereby people can vote and be involved in having their voices heard about how they want to be governed and have a contribution and a decisive input to how the country is run. I don't think just bringing the Shah back and going back to the 1970s will be a long-term solution, but it could be a transitional process.
Your parents fled Iran in the 1970s because of religious persecution. How important are the current events there for you?
I think many Iranians who are outside of Iran long for Iran returning to a country that welcomes religious diversity.
Dr. Shahram Dana is a senior law lecturer at Griffith University. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. After a crucial meeting at the White House, Denmark's foreign minister has declared his nation fundamentally disagrees with the American president on the future of Greenland. European nations are bolstering their military presence in the Danish territory as Donald Trump again demands that the world's largest island should be under US control for security reasons. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Greenlanders are openly rattled by US President Donald Trump's escalating rhetoric about taking over their homeland. Some, like Nuuk resident Liv Jensen, are hopeful the high-level meeting between Denmark and Greenland officials and the Trump administration has helped to ease tensions.
They keep fighting about Greenland, but now they agree to disagree. That is very good, I think. I think we'll sleep better tonight.
US Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland in Washington. Afterwards, Denmark said the parties had agreed to disagree, reiterating that a US takeover of the territory is totally unacceptable. Greenlander Liv Jensen remains uneasy.
We are afraid of that he can take us like that, and our culture will disappear, our language will disappear, and the whole way of living in Greenland will disappear and be American.
President Trump has hinted he may take the island by force, arguing the US needs total control to counter Russian and Chinese aggression, despite Greenland being subject to protections under NATO. He maintained that position after the meeting.
I have a very good relationship with Denmark, and we'll see how it all works out. I think something will work out.
Sweden, France and Norway have begun sending armed forces to Greenland at Denmark's request. Denmark is also increasing its military presence and Germany is sending troops on a reconnaissance mission. Lars Rasmussen is the Danish foreign minister.
We had what I will describe as a frank but also constructive discussion. The discussions focused on how to ensure the long-term security in Greenland. And here our perspectives continue to differ, I must say. The president has made his view clear, and we have a different position.
Trump has been adamant the US needs Greenland for security reasons, but the world's largest island also has significant mineral deposits. Leon Sinclair is a postdoctoral research fellow with the University of Sydney.
Greenland does have a range of different mineral deposits which have been becoming more accessible in recent years as the ice sheet melts. Many of these deposits in Greenland do have rare earth elements, which are crucial components in wind turbines, in electric vehicle motors because they're used to make those really lightweight, powerful, permanent magnets.
Resources, in particular oil, loomed large in the US's recent intervention in Venezuela. But Dr. Sinclair believes the circumstances are different for Greenland.
All of the deposits in Greenland are undeveloped. While these deposits are large and significant, there are also large and significant deposits of rare earth elements all around the world in much more accessible locations. What's missing in the mineral supply chain in the West, in the USA, is not actually deposits of minerals in the ground. There's lots of those everywhere. What's missing is the technology, the refineries to process those rare earth elements. It's that manufacturing piece of the supply chain of the production network that is missing.
The US and Denmark have agreed to form a working group to discuss a wide range of concerns regarding Greenland.
Alexandra Humphreys. Well, distance running seems to be particularly popular at the moment, with more than 50,000 Australians completing a marathon last year. But for some athletes, a mere 42 Ks is just a warm-up. They're turning to crazier forms of racing to satisfy their itch to run, as Luke Radford found out.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
At the end of most major running races, you'll see an inflatable archway with the word finish in big bold letters. But at this race, it instead reads, there is no finish. That's because there's only one way to win. Keep running laps until you're the last one standing.
Just quit now!
Welcome to the sport of Backyard Ultra.
Yeah, I think the more that I do them, the more that I really love them.
South Australian Dan Kamak is a relative newcomer to the sport of Backyard Ultra, but given he holds the unofficial world record for the fastest marathon ever run in Crocs, he's not unused to pain or strange races, and Backyard Ultra loomed as the ultimate challenge.
Most other races, you know, you do a marathon, that's 42Ks, or you do a 6-hour race, you know where the finish line is. So unlike any other format, you can really push to your absolute limit. It just comes down to, at the end of the day, who's the most stubborn, who has the strongest mindset.
The way a Backyard Ultra race works is remarkably simple. At the start of every hour, you set off to run a 6.7-kilometre course. However much time you have left after you cross the line is your rest period before the next hour begins and you start running again. Sounds easy, until you realise that if you finish a lap with just 5 or 10 minutes left in the hour, that's your only chance to eat, go to the toilet, and even sleep. It's an utterly ruthless sport, but Dan says, conversely, it's very wholesome.
It's just such a lovely community as well. Everyone's really welcoming and friendly and happy to share tips. And it's a very social event. You can be lining up there with Phil Gore, the world record holder, chatting with him, and then the next hour you line up with him again.
In the world of Backyard Ultra, the name of West Australian runner Phil Gore is spoken with an equal degree of reverence and fear. He's not just the current world champion, he's the current world record holder. Back in June at Dead Cow Gully in outback Queensland, he ran 797 kilometres in 5 days and only stopped because the guy in second couldn't go further. But as Phil Gore himself admits, it wasn't always that way.
So in the beginning, I was only really interested in doing 5Ks, had no interest in doing ultramarathons. I had seen people do ultramarathons and I thought it was very impressive, but I was just like, this is not something I would do. I'm pretty happy just doing the fast stuff.
But after entering his first Backyard Ultra on a whim, he was hooked.
And I kind of just played it by ear, like I just went by feel. I had no system as to having pre-planned faster laps or slower laps. It was just whatever I felt like on the lap, that's what I would run.
On that attempt, Phil managed 39 hours. But since then, he's refined race strategy and his diet down to the last gram of carbohydrates. Not that it stops him from indulging in the occasional meat pie mid-race.
Gabby, who's my nutritionist, she was down at the bakery, at the local bakery, and she sent a photo just asking, you know, does anyone want anything from here? But because I was in the group as well, I messaged back and said, oh, I could really go a meat pie. She thought I was joking, and she ended up getting a pie, but it was for one of the other crew. And then so I ended up eating the pie that was originally for Nathan. And I, like, demolished it.
Backyard Ultra may be somewhat of a niche sport, but thanks to the internet, it's found a ready-made audience. Its predictable hourly format is well-suited to live streaming. David Patterson, better known as Patto, is the host of the Backyard Ultra podcast and a guest commentator at races.
if you follow them and watch the live streams and you see the runners come back to camp after they've finished a loop, it's pretty captivating footage and it's pretty inspiring too. It spikes on the hour. So because the loop starts on the hour every hour, people know when to tune in.
Backyard Ultra participation is growing every year, and Paddo thinks it won't be long before it becomes a serious professional sport.
I think it wouldn't surprise me if a professional league starts one day, and like you have like the ATP tennis tour, you've got like the Grand Slams. I wouldn't surprise me if in a few years there's something similar to that with backyard ultras.
What a sport. Luke Radford with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump says help is on its way. The Iranians, who have taken to the streets in the biggest uprising since the 1979 revolution. But what does he mean by help? Is he ready to order military strikes as the death toll continues to climb into the thousands? Today, Hussein Abish from the Arab Gulf States Institute on what to expect in the days ahead. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.